The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, there's a reason we're both on cell phones today. Can you explain what we're doing and why?
Hey, Kevin, we're in New York City and we're spending about 3 days here and then an additional 3 days in Washington, D.C., because this really is the power corridor. If you look at the U.S. dollar, if you look at the bond market, if you look at the stock market, if you look at policy decisions that are being made today, which will shape America as we know it tomorrow, then this is, well, for lack of a better phrase, ground zero. This is where the stuff is happening. And I'm afraid, Kevin, this is also where the bad stuff is happening. I've noticed, Kevin, that the currency markets the last week or two have been virtually schizophrenic. I'm thinking about the dollar, and every day, just like a yo-yo, it depends on what comes out of Europe in terms of an announcement. But the Greek debt has long been the issue, well, at least most recently been the issue, and that is playing havoc with the currency market.
David, do you think that's one of the only reasons the dollar's been showing strength here recently is because the euro is just so incredibly weak based on all this sovereign default debt?
This is the problem with a floating currency system. It's not where you have currencies judged on their own merits, but they're judged relative to someone else's merits, or in the case of the Greeks, demerits.
Yes.
So this is a classic Gresham's law where bad money is driving up good. And it's just hilarious to see the pundits come on, and I enjoy coming to New York because, I mean, these guys are so high-strung, and having to come up with a solution every 2 seconds for what this particular tick on the tape means. The dollar's up, the dollar's down, the dollar's up, the dollar's down. I mean, it's one point here, one point there, and we're trying to interpret these micro-movements, and the tragedy is we've lost connection with the macro picture to begin with.
Well, and David, the macro picture, I mean, one of the reasons we're going to Washington, D.C. after the New York trip is because the macro picture is truly affected more by political right now than it is the financial. I mean, if you look at the European Union, yes, Greece is in a mess, but really everybody's been hanging on Merkel's every word or you know, it's political decision making. You said the same thing was happening here in the United States 2 years ago. You said that was the progression. We go from the financial to the economic to the political. This will be the first time any of the videos will be made in Washington, D.C., or a political power state.
Well, that's right. So we're spending 3 days here, 3 days in Washington, D.C., and it's to explore some of these connections, to meet with various people, to spend time in specific places as we put together the next DVD for 2010. If you'll recall, we made a DVD in 2008, which was When Greed Turns to Fear.
That was the financial crisis.
Exactly. So the spring of 2008, we laid out the problems with the derivatives market and what we viewed as an untenable situation in the market, one where you create enough problems and they ultimately come home to roost. And they did that fall. They did in the fall of 2008 in a very significant way. 2009, we put together a separate DVD, and that was Conquering the Chaos, Sound Investment Strategies in an Uncertain World. And there I think we have captured the ideas of a basic strategy which keeps people's assets intact and takes a cautious yet winsome look at the markets and has people protected and in a position to profit in the future when things do get better.
Well, and by 2009, it had rolled to the economic. People really were feeling it in their pocketbook by 2009. Maybe not 2008, but now we're starting to feel not only in the pocketbook, but as far as votes go and as far as our political, the whole political realm at this point is uncertain.
Right. I'm reminded of the guest we had a number of months ago where Keynes Went Wrong was the book that Hunter Lewis wrote. And in it, he looked at, you know, basically the Keynesian policies that have gotten us into this problem and the fact that they are offering nothing but Keynesian solutions to a very Keynesian problem. And I think that, again, is it's an interesting trip when you come to New York to realize just how small the world is here in terms of a world of ideologies, because it really is just one voice that's heard, whether it's CNBC, CNN FM, the pundits there, the money managers, with your big wirehouse firms, very few think in terms of free markets. Most think in terms of the state's role in intervention. And that's not just sort of bailing out Chrysler or bailing out the car industry, bailing out Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. We're talking about zero interest rate policies and the unintended consequences that that has into the marketplace, the rampant speculation which that causes. Kevin, it's a reminder, too, spending some time down on Wall and Broad this morning and thinking about the crisis of 1907. The crisis of 1907 was brought about by a piece of legislation.
That came about in 1906, right?
That's exactly right. The Interstate Commerce Committee decided that it was only fair to set prices for rail carriage. And in so doing, again, this is where legislators are not market makers. They just don't. It's not their world. It's not their world. Legislators put into play something that caused the transport, mainly the railroad companies, which were a huge part of the Dow at that point, to crumble.
So it was the transports that precipitated the crash of 1907.
Well, exactly, because then there was a broad market sell-off. And shortly thereafter, you've got senators, legislators coming back with new policies to solve the problem, which, oh, my goodness, they started in the first place.
Well, sure, we've got a new problem. Now we have a financial crisis. There have been banking failures. J.P. Morgan stepped in and consolidated a lot. But what did that lead to, Dave?
It reminds me, maybe you've seen the sitcom The Office, and you have these politics where if someone has the job, they want to keep it, and so you do what you can to ensure your long-term survivability in this place. And legislators are no different. I mean, they basically create an infinite amount of work for themselves. Lawyers do the same thing. Oh, what do you know? Most legislators come from a legal background. You cause one problem and solve it with 10 new ones. And it's this constant work. I'm interested, because next week we will be in Washington, I'm interested to explore some of this further, where I just don't think the founding fathers really intended our legislatures to be full-time legislature.
Making laws all the time. A little bit like, brokers continually churning trades, right?
Well, exactly. If you look at the corrupt side of Wall Street, where a brokerage business or a chop shop or a bucket shop, as you might call it, takes a client and just grinds them into the ground by churning their account, this is exactly what our legislature is doing. Only they're grinding us, they're grinding we the people into the ground with the legislation that they are producing.
Well, David, that takes me to a question then, because you've been talking about the concern that when we get into a crisis, legislatures start becoming protectionist. They start controlling things. You've been warning about capital controls, the control of money between nations. H.R. 2847, tell us about it.
Well, the irony, Kevin, is that every piece of legislation that has ever come out and really hurt us as a country, has had a strange name to it, either an acronym that alluded to something positive or something that was intended to just scare the living daylights out of you.
So this one has a name.
Well, the acronym is HIRE, H-I-R-E. It's the jobs bill. And you might think, well, the jobs bill, goodness, this is extending the programs which are going to help us rebuild our highways. It's going to create new jobs. But lo and behold, page 27 gets into something that is very specific to our tax code, and very specific to an issue which just scares the living daylights out of me, which is capital controls. I am all for government having their fair share of the tax take. That is not an issue with me at all. I don't believe people should ever avoid taxes. That would be a misconception in my concern. My concern is that when any country in the past has raised barriers, the capital control barriers, as we are beginning to here with H.R. 2847, the next thing that comes, the next two things that come, are an intense amount of taxation over the top. So if you were, on an aggregated basis at the 35 to 50% level, expect 65 to 70. I mean, we're going back to sort of the pre-Carter era in terms of taxation. But that's not the most scary thing, because those things change and it fluctuates in light of the administration. The next administration may just lower those. So that's not the real concern. Capital controls are put in place just before a major inflation occurs as well.
So this is a repeating theme. What you're talking about is we go into a crisis, people start squirming, basically. The government comes in, legislates capital controls. Then at that point, they raise taxes, and that's a precursor to to high inflation, which just kills everyone's buying power.
And again, there's not a causal connection between taxes and inflation.
Right.
But both of those issues are symptomatic of a failed state. You know, the fact that you are now in a last-ditch effort trying to raise as much capital as you can, I just imagine the Treasury working feverishly under the deck to patch holes in the ship before it takes on so much water that the ship is irretrievable. That's what the capital control measure is. The water is coming on so fast into the ship that we now have the desperation, the Hail Mary throw, if you will. This is where it all comes down to the rubber meeting the road. We're in a crisis. If you thought we were recovering, why capital control?
Well, now, David, let me ask you, just, you know, let's just go through the basics. What is capital control? I mean, what are capital controls for dummies, let's say, if you were to buy the book?
When a domestic economy is experiencing serious trouble, the last thing that they want is prices of any good or service to get out of whack because the currency is being manipulated or driven one way or the other because massive amounts of money are either coming into
right.
the market or flowing out. Capital controls can actually be there to say, no, we don't want your money in our country.
Mm-hmm.
Capital controls can also say, no, we don't want your money to leave our country.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends. I mean, they're either holding their hands up to say stop, which we're seeing throughout Asia right now, saying, listen, just like the 1997-98 Asian contagion, what happened is hot money flows, speculative money went into the market in Asia and then came out so fast that they couldn't adjust to it, and it caused the collapse.
So either direction, it's like a wall. It basically stops the flow of money between countries.
It's unstable money flows that you want to contain because that jeopardizes the stability of the currency. And all that is very reasonable and rational, but you generally see capital controls, or another word for them is exchange controls, implemented. Sometimes it's during wartime. Some other times it's because there is an economic crisis and you're in the process of doing two things, either expanding the debt or devaluing your home currency through inflation, and you can't afford to have destabilizing factor money flights, like capital flights, going into other currencies and ditching your currency.
And now capital controls are a clear and present danger because they're right there in H.R. 2847.
Kevin, as we came out here to record this DVD, what I was struggling with was kind of the linchpin. We've seen the financial situation deteriorate dramatically over the last few years. 2006, 7, and 8 were clearly a financial crisis for the balance sheets of Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, AIG. The list goes on and on.
Right.
And the shotgun marriages that followed between, you know, J.P. Morgan, Chase, Wachovia, Merrill Lynch, Bank of America. I mean, that was crisis mode in the financial world. The economy is now front and center in terms of a crisis. The man on the street is not happy, concerned about losing his job. The jobless rate continues to deteriorate, not get better. Even though the numbers are improving, they're simply dropping off people who were on the rolls because they've been discouraged, quote-unquote, workers, and have not been able to find a job for the last 12 months. That categorizes them as no longer unemployed.
If they're out of a job for a year, I mean, if they're out of a job for a year, obviously they're discouraged and they really don't need to be counted anymore. But they still eat. They're still hungry. They still have mortgages. You've got to count them.
That's true. And I guess the struggle for me has been to see what exactly is the evidence beyond proposed legislation, but there's a difference between proposed legislation and legislation that's gone through.
Right.
Proposed legislation is something that is sort of like a haunting specter. It may or may not be an issue. It remains in your mind as a boogeyman, but until it's got flesh and blood and bones, it's not necessarily the real thing, a threat or a real and present danger. What you have with legislation that's been passed is quite different. And so bringing home to me that the guys in Washington do actually understand how bad the economy is. Even though they've got the rah-rah cheerleading crowd out, they do understand. The message you're getting verbally is that things are better. But you watch what people do, not what they say. And what you find is that they're scared out of their gourd. They're scared out of their minds. There's no reason to implement capital controls. There's no reason to prevent flight out of the dollar, unless you're anticipating a massive flight out of the dollar for very specific reasons. And you and I would agree, this is all about a sovereign debt crisis, whether it's 2010, 11, or 12, we've got a significant collapse in the U.S. bond market on the horizon, and the last thing you can afford to have is massive capital flight out.
Just a reminder, you're listening to David McIlvaney and Kevin Orrick via cell phone for the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary this week in New York and later Washington, D.C. at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Well, you know, David, one of our guests a couple of weeks ago, Russell Napier, was saying that the United States Treasury, the Treasury bills and the Treasury bonds, were what we would consider zero risk. That's what we would mark everything else to. But now we're facing a period of time where even Treasury debt may be downgraded by the rating agencies.
Well, and you raise an interesting point, because what you basically have with Treasuries are the most mispriced markets on the planet. They've been mispriced for a decade, and they remain glaringly obtuse in terms of how they're priced. And yet we still think of there being an efficient market where, yo, everyone understands the risks involved in Treasuries. I beg to differ. Given there's two kinds of people who would be wanting to leave the U.S. dollar or take money out of this country, and it's foreign capital that just wants to repatriate, or domestic capital that says, gosh, I don't know that I like what I see. The domestic capital comes in two categories. The business dollars, and they're still free to come and go as they please. Multinationals aren't going to be impaired at this point. If you've got accounts in South America, North America, Canada, China, Japan, there is still a free flow of capital. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the exchange between us, the United States of America, and China, and to see if that remains the case in terms of business dollars and their ability to move from one country to another.
Yes, but what about the person who wants to save money outside of the United States?
That is what has just become a near impossibility. H.R. 2847 is closing the door for individuals and the investor dollars. I mean, there's a whole host of things. They might not like the political environment we're in. They might not like the dollar. They might not like an increase in taxation. They might not like social or political destabilization. They might not like the threat of war and what that means for their investments, and they may choose either a hard currency or another asset class, but certainly having money in another domicile, that becomes a priority. Unfortunately, I think this is legislation that is intended to close that door.
So that money becomes captive, basically, to the country that it's in. In this case, that's the United States.
Right. Kevin, this is something that is common. It's not as if this is just sort of a theoretical boogeyman, because we had this in Germany, we had it in France, we had it in Great Britain, we had it in Italy, we had it in Spain.
Well, let me ask you a question then, Dave. Has it ever worked? I mean, it seems like this occurs right before a depression and then an inflation.
Well, yes and no. It captures a certain number of dollars or francs or pounds or marks or whatever the currency may be that they're trying to keep in place. What comes with it, though, is a little bit disturbing, and it feels a lot sort of like statist language. Somewhere between 1984 and Brave New World, where government or Big Brother or this great organization who is, you know, ensuring peace and prosperity and guaranteeing your safety for eternity, they are, in fact, raising the bar in terms of the language used. Are you an enemy of the state? Are you a traitor? Are you going to be tried as a traitor? And again, going back to the language used when legislation is implemented, it's either there to scare the living daylights out of you or to convince you that everything is all right.
Right.
The higher program, it means that government is on top of it. They're doing their best to fix things. Well, and the Trading with the Enemy Act is a classic case
right.
in point. You go back to 1933. And under the Trading with the Enemy Act, it was illegal for you to own gold. The implication is, if you own gold, you're not a loyal U.S. citizen, and you're in violation of the Trading with the Enemy Act.
Yeah, so thus, by association, it makes you the enemy. Or what they'll do, Dave, they'll name the bill something you absolutely can't deny, like HIRE, H-I-R-E, or the Patriot Bill. I mean, who doesn't want to be a patriot here in America?
And again, Kevin, this is not an American issue, and this is not an Obama issue. This is a universal issue. When governments get desperate, they do desperate things, and then they start pointing fingers, blaming other people. That's really what we'll get to perhaps in next year's DVD and just a little bit this year, because we're not there yet. But in terms of the international conflict, the international ramifications, the geopolitical ramifications of the present crisis. Because what you have developing in the context of currency controls or capital controls or exchange controls, it's language like the French used back in 1936. Yet they started blaming the government of Germany for attacking them financially, for doing everything they could to destabilize the French. When in fact, if you looked at the French balance sheet, you'd say, oh, well, they're bankrupt. It's not very smart to keep your money in France. But what they did was basically create a straw man and say, it's the Germans. The Germans are out to get it. The Germans are destabilizing their government. It's the Germans. It's the old enemy that is responsible for selling French paper and buying gold. And again, it's this hypersensitive political environment where if you have chosen to do something that under different circumstances would be totally benign, you are now an enemy of the state.
Yeah.
We just live in absolutely fascinating times.
Well, David, I was thinking when you were talking about that, about Charles de Gaulle in the 1960s, who also started to realize that the U.S. dollar was not going to be forever redeemable in gold. So he did the thing that was very best for his country, but the blame went, it was the French. It was the French. The reason that Nixon had to close the gold window in 1971, it was the French.
It really is interesting because I grew up with this sense that the French were a lesser than country. I'm just being a little bit confessional here. I'm not saying that I think that.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up in an environment, and not even my home, but our culture, and I think America in general looks at the French and says, you know, we don't like the French wines. We talk to clients all the time. If it's French gold, they're not interested. Or if it's a French bond, they're not interested. Why? Because it's French.
Right.
And I've seen that in restaurants where there's a bias towards American wines over French wines. And I wonder where that stigma comes from, really. We can say, well, they were cowards during the war. I don't think that was necessarily the case. And looking out at the Statue of Liberty, I see their graciousness, their gift to us, their celebration of what we did here. I mean, we have some deep connections with that culture, and yet de Gaulle and Jacques Roux pulled the plug and wanted gold delivered to them because they no longer trusted the U.S. dollar.
It was their right.
And now we have this generational bias, not really knowing why, but we have this generational bias against the country. We just did the right thing for the people. It was common sense.
Well, now, what country is going to be the fall guy on this next one? I mean, we're starting to see at this point some tensions internationally. Who do you see will start to take the fall guy kind of rap with the next crisis?
You know, it's tough to say. Is it the one that seems most obvious, or is it someone that they're going to pull out of the rabbit and is very unsuspecting? The story is being developed, but it hasn't been delivered.
Right.
The obvious one is China.
Yeah, sure.
The obvious one is China because, you know, they are currency manipulators, according to the Treasury. They are manipulators, according to 130 of our legislators. So there is brewing conflict there, and they may get the blame.
Well, David, going back to capital controls, we've been talking about other countries taking the blame. I mean, is this just the beginning, or is this something that we're going to realize the full ramifications of right away?
No, it's going to take some time to see this. I would say that 28, 47 is nothing but the camel getting his nose under the tent, and we'll see the rest of the camel shortly. You need reporting requirements for moving cash into and out of the country, which we largely have.
Now, this is under this new bill.
No, this is more fully what I think you'll see develop as we have full-blown foreign currency or capital controls. But some of these, this would be sort of the laundry list of things that you would expect. And we're just basically adding to the list because some of this already exists. But reporting requirements for moving cash into and out of the country, reporting on all foreign financial accounts, these are, again, things that have been done. And the list goes on. You need reporting requirements for transferring assets into and out of the country. Assets, not just cash. And Congress is aggressively going after it, figuring out how to make that happen. You would probably see more of a declaration of an economic emergency, something like an executive order placing all money movements under the eye of the Treasury or the Fed because of something that is destabilizing the market.
Yeah, some sort of unexpected event that we don't know what's coming right now, but would pull the trigger.
Exactly. So something more draconian in terms of an executive order that would come down, and that would be the rest of the camel getting into the tent. You know, exchange from one currency to another, that would be, classically, it was down according to a fixed rate, and we would have a floating rate. And this is where, you know, you can see in the past where there's been premiums and discounts on a given currency on the black market, you know, where you end up having the official market, quote unquote, with a fixed rate, and then the black market where everyone else trades the currency.
Right.
And so, yeah, the government is clueless, and they're assuming a value of 10x when the real value is 2x. Good luck with that.
So in a way, Gresham's law still applies, even when the laws say no.
It still applies. It just matters who's going to be compliant or not. So that's a separate issue and certainly more of a historical observation. Kevin, I'm reminded of William Knickerbocker's quote, gold would have value for no other reason than it enables a citizen to fashion his financial escape from the state. I don't know that people even have to be concerned about capital controls if they have an adequate or healthy apportionment to the metal itself. Because again, whether you're looking at it as a currency allocation, whether you're looking at it as a simple diversification for family net worth, it is something that in the context of state confiscation of assets, and I mean specifically through inflation, you have to be aware of. And why is inflation more of an issue today than it was yesterday, last month, 6 months ago, 6 years ago? It's because the economic crisis continues to snowball out of control. And as it gets worse and moves and morphs into a political crisis, we end up having those negative feedback loops, the negative feedback loops where policies beget other financial crises and new economic issues to solve. And the things that were intended to be helpful end up actually hurting in the long run because they were really Band-Aid solutions and not long-term, viable, workable solutions. So, Kevin, I enjoy being here in New York as a market practitioner. Number one, as an observer, as an outside observer, I can tell you I really prefer living in Durango than here. But it's an interesting experience to come and spend time here. We spent time today in the place where the Treasury Department used to store their gold in the 1860s and 70s.
Yeah, that was amazing. Walking through vault after vault after vault where the United States, the original United States, when George Washington first took office, kept their actual value money. Now, Dave, those vaults were empty today. They're full of just folding chairs and storage of just, it's like a basement storage room. Why? Because we don't have gold backing the currency anymore, I would think.
Yeah, no, there was something of a parody in the two bricks that were sitting on the floor that were painted with gold. And you know,
not real gold.
What was and what is. We used to have gold in those basements, and now there's no reason to store it because money today is nothing but ones and zeros in the digital ether. And we can expand that supply infinitely and instantly. And I think that's, again, one of the reasons why I enjoy coming back here, because you get to see the history of markets as they've developed and brought us to this point in history. Very significant to look forward. We would be hampered if we weren't looking back and keenly aware of our present state. And so that's where we're at, Kevin. Next week, we'll have an exploration of some ideas relating to Washington. And the week after that, we have the former European Central Bank chief joining us on the program. So many questions relating to not only central banking in the United States, but globally, and the impact of current policy decisions internationally.
Well, I'll be looking forward to that. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can always give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.